Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Scott L. Gardner, curator of parasites in the H.W. Manter Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska State Museum and professor of biological sciences at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. We're going to be talking about his new book written with Judy Diamond and Gabor Raj, Parasites, The Inside Story. Scott, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about parasites.
Thank you very much for having me on.
What I love about this book is, first of all and foremost, you make the case why people really, okay, they may not warm up to parasites, but they should care about parasites.
Yes. Well, you know, I've been teaching parasitology for 30 years, and I've been doing it since I was just a kid. So once you figure out really what they are, it's something that can just really go, and you really should care about them because there's so many opportunities to get them. Plus, they make so much of a difference in our world.
Well, one of the other things I learned in your book is it's a way to trace evolution and movements of animals.
Right. That's one of the things that I think is the most cool. I mean, looking at the work we've done on marsupials.
Yeah.
In South America and Australia, and looking at the times that those divergences happened, you know, 60 million years is pretty deep phylogeny, deep historical ecology that we're looking at.
I know. And as a person who is very interested in ecology and natural history, I have to admit, I never gave parasites the long view. And once you start thinking, like, how long some of these parasites have been infecting hosts, it's amazing.
It is. And it's even more amazing when you think about the extinction events that happened on the Earth.
Yeah.
The 80 million, you know, what do we have? At the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary when we got smacked with that asteroid down there in the isthmus in the area of the Gulf of Mexico, the global extinction event that happened was amazing. But then the sharks were still living in the oceans. They didn't go extinct, and so they went through that one. So if you look at the diversity of parasites in sharks, it's really amazingly and stunningly deep. I don't work on sharks, but it's such an interesting thing, you just can't avoid talking about it sometimes.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the diversity of parasites. And let's just talk about endoparasites. Those are parasites that are inside an organism,
right,
as opposed to ectoparasites, which are on the surface, like ticks would be an ectoparasite. The diversity is incredible, and the numbers are mind-boggling.
Yes, if you look at, well, if you kind of make a quick calculation and look at the number of species of mammals, it's like something like 6,500 species of mammals that have been described. Every single mammal has two to four host-specific species of parasites. Those parasites might only occur in that one individual mammal, that one individual species of mammal, but... So then you add that up, and you have like four times as many species of parasites as you do just mammals. And then you add that into birds and everything else, and it's just mind-boggling, really.
It's incredible. You describe them as unseen influencers.
Yes, that is, because you usually don't see these things. Like, for instance, some of the species that that change the behavior of the host. I mean, we can get into that later.
Oh, yeah.
They are mind-boggling, the numbers of species out there, and we don't really know very much at all. We probably know less than 1%, less than one-half of 1% of the life cycles, of the complete life histories of these things, because we just don't know much about them in nature.
Is there a hard definition of parasite and parasitism?
Yeah, the one that I like to use is an organism that lives in or on another organism, and it causes it some harm. And so that's really the definition. And it's got to be harmful somehow.
But a parasite doesn't want the host to die, though, does it? I mean, not that it wants, but it doesn't behoove the parasite to kill the host.
It does not. Well, there are some that it might, but in most cases it doesn't, because if you have a pinworm living inside this rodent, inside the intestine of a rodent, it's just sitting in there, and there are only a few of them, or maybe there are hundreds, but they usually don't do very much at all. the interesting thing about that definition is that the harm might be almost undetectable. It could be just two or three bits of glucose out of the whole diet of an animal. But if it is a little bit over a long period of time, it might make a difference in evolutionary time. So the real definition of that is the parasite really has to cause some level of harm, but it could be almost nothing, or it could be massive. Like if some people get infected with something like Chagas disease, and once you're infected with it, and you're young and you hadn't been treated quickly, it's basically you can never get rid of the infection because it goes intercellular. It goes in among your cells, and you just can never get at it because it's in immunoprivileged sites that are just not accessible by your immune system of the body.
Speaking of Chagas' disease, as you write about in the book, it's interesting because parasites can also talk to us in a roundabout way about global climate change. In that, isn't Chagas' disease starting to spread a little bit further north than it did before?
Well, one of our colleagues here, Carl Reinhardt, who works on ancient history of humans in North America, well, all over the place, but we are finding some remains of humans that have indications of Chagas disease several thousand years ago in North America. But we do know that some of the intermediate hosts or even the vectors like the kissing bugs are moving north more because it's more habitable climate for them. So we're actually getting some movement of these animals to the north. They're, for instance, out where I teach our course called Field Parasitology in western Nebraska. In the last 2 years, we found these Chagas bugs, and we had never found them before, but of course, you know, maybe we weren't looking really hard, but now we found them a couple of times. They're called Regiviades. Triatoma is the genus. And so the ones that we looked at were not infected, but they're there, and so they could be transmitting out there or anywhere in this part of the country. It's interesting.
You can also use parasites to track human movements prehistorically. I'm thinking about across the Bering Strait.
Oh, yeah, that was an interesting paper we did. That was with Carl and a guy named one of our dear colleagues in Brazil, Adauto Ruggio. He's expired now. But we all worked on this project where we're looking at distinct types of parasites that you could use for tracking people. So some of the parasites, like hookworms, for instance, probably really couldn't go with people across Beringia because hookworms, the nematode, which lives in the intestine of humans, has to have an external part of the life cycle. So the nematode eggs come out in the feces, and then they hatch, and then they begin feeding on the bacteria in the feces, and then they have to then penetrate the skin of a person again. So hookworms are an example of something that would have been filtered out by the Beringian crossing. So pinworms, on the other hand, are intimately related, and they don't have to have much of an external life history. They don't come out and run around on them on their own eating bacteria. They're immediately infective once they come out of the body, out of the anus, so to speak. So pinworms are an example of something that could have come all the way through Beringia, but some of the others just couldn't do it. So it's an interesting way to look at distributions if you know the life cycles of these animals.
Now, did I read this correctly in the book? Analysis of DNA from at least three South American tribes suggests that there were earlier migrations to the New World from Australia? Australasia?
Yeah, so that was one of the hypotheses, is that there's a couple of different routes, three different routes that could have happened for people getting and populating the New World. One of them is coming straight across, because we know that people got to Easter Island, and they were there for a long time before they were discovered by Western people. It's not that far from the South American coast, and so there is some information, some data out there that show there could have been a possible trans-Pacific transfer of people from the Polynesian area.
Wow.
Right across. And so that needs more work. There needs to be more work done on the parasites of those areas down there to see whether or not there is a good DNA signature of the parasites themselves in addition to what might be in the people.
Malaria is another disease you can track human movements of.
Another one?
Malaria.
Yes, malaria is a good one. Others
in, malaria, especially in slaves brought to America.
Yes. In fact, that's probably how most of the hookworms made it over here. But malaria transmitted by Plasmodium, which is, Plasmodium is the genus of the parasite that is transmitted among people via mosquitoes. Malaria is the disease that people get when they get the malaria or get the Plasmodium infection. So that is another one. Of course, schistosomes also were another one. So there's several of them that can be used to track how people are moving around. Schistosomes probably were not, at least the ones that are more normally in humans, probably were not in the what we call the New World, North or South America, before people were brought enslaved from Africa to both North and South America. So they probably brought both Plasmodium and schistosomes with them, because in South America, these schistosomes, those are the trematodes that use snails as intermediate hosts. So we could go on for days talking about this, but it's pretty interesting.
It's amazing. The reproductive rates of some of these parasites is mind-boggling.
Oh, yeah, it is. For instance, some quick calculations of the number of parasites called Ascaris in people is just, you can't even hardly believe it, because I made some calculations one time. If you look at the number of Ascaris in people, about one-fourth of the human population is infected at any one time.
Wow.
With that one, yes. In fact, I had it. I was in Bolivia working in 1985, and I came back and I did a quick check, because I always do when I come back from some place that you're not really sure of the food. And I saw eggs on the slide. I was going, okay. And usually I'm doing that. I'm looking at an animal species. I said, no problem. But then I was realizing that was from me. So it was very interesting to see that.
Reality check.
Yes. Yeah, really interesting. So so I don't study that one a lot, but that's one of the species that we wrote a couple of papers on, and then we do discuss it in the book too. The interesting thing about that is the number of eggs produced by those things. These are called geohelminths. The only way you can get infected with these is if someone defecates who's infected, and it has eggs from, there's both males and females living in your intestine, mating and then producing eggs that are viable, and they come out of the feces and they either get in water or in food or on food. The eggs of these things can last in 5 or 10% formalin for 25 years in a bottle.
Oh, wow.
And still be infective. And so these things lying around outside, if they're not in the sun kills them. That's the one good thing about sunlight, is that it wipes this stuff out. But if it's in a shaded area, if it's in an area of shade, in a moist or not too dry, not too moist area, the eggs can last a really long time. And we've found just Ascaris lying around in little schoolyards in Bolivia when we were working down there. So even though there were latrines, obviously a nematode came out and someone passed it, and they said, yuck, they threw it down, and on they went. And one of my graduate students picked it up, was looking at it. She said, what's this? I said, that's an Ascaris. And just as she was getting ready to drop it, it blew up and all the eggs flew on her. So I don't know if she ever got infected or not with that one.
Whoa!
That was weird.
Now, Ascaris go back to dinosaurs, don't they?
Oh, these things go back a long ways, yes. Because
So Scott, a lot of parasites are species-specific. As a matter of fact, in the book you mentioned, there's some parasite that lives only in the anus of hippos.
Yes, that's a leech that only lives,
right. Okay,
only in hippos. Most leeches are ectoparasites that live on the outside, but this one lives up in the anus of the hippos, and there it is. And so, it doesn't occur in anything else, but in hippos. And I don't know how many hippos there were.
But if these are so long lived through prehistory to today,
yes.
The question I always have is, okay, how do they eventually move to another host? Like, how does that occur?
Yes.
I think some examples you give in your book is on Galapagos Island.
Right. We're just finishing up this nice little paper describing a new species of tapeworm from these mice that live there called rice rats. And they're endemic species that live on the Galapagos, and they've probably been jumping around the Galapagos a little bit since they arrived there several million years ago. And so we looked at these tapeworms in them, and we're finding that we thought initially that maybe they were tapeworms from the birds that are there, because it seemed like it would be easier to do, because it seems unlikely, however improbable, that a rodent would show up fully infected and finding the correct intermediate host, because all tapeworms have to use an intermediate host. The way it works really quickly is the eggs come out in the feces, an intermediate host eats the feces, becomes infected, and then the intermediate host is then ingested by the definitive host again, which is in this case a mouse or the Galapagos rice rat. And so it just seems strange that something, well, of course, the probability of these things happening is infinitesimally small anyway, but the tapeworms in those Galapagos rice rats, I was wondering, maybe they jumped from the birds to the rice rats, but we don't know because there are no data on the parasites of birds from the Galapagos, unfortunately.
Isn't it possible that they came from the ants? Is that what I read?
No, the ants are actually perhaps the intermediate hosts. That's what we're thinking.
Wow. Yes,
the ants were there, and so it turns out that the intermediate host for these types of tapeworms, which is called Raleatina, has been shown by a guy working in Kansas that ants are the intermediate host. So these rabbits had these tapeworms in them, and the tapeworms called Raleatina came out of the ants or came out of the feces of the rabbit in Kansas, and he worked that life cycle out. So it's basically using the comparative methods, which we use for doing things where we can't do experiments. We're speculating that it's ants that are the intermediates, but we don't have any real data on it, just speculation at this point.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Scott L. Gardner, curator of parasites in the H.W. Mantor Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska State Museum and professor of biological sciences at the University of Nebraska Lincoln. His new book, written with Judy Diamond and Gabor Rasch, is Parasites, the Inside Story. Well, you brought up tapeworms, and there's a lot about tapeworms in this book. One of the first things I realized, which should have been obvious to me, that different size hosts have different size tapeworms. So there is a tapeworm that infests whales.
Yes. It's called Polygonoporus, and it is one that it's pretty big. We have one hanging, we have a model of one hanging in our public museum here called Morrill Hall, and it is in on the ceiling. Most people don't bother looking up, but if you look at the plaque and it says "look up," and you look up and you see this really big thing that's life size basically, and it's huge. And so, really, the reason is because these things are living in a whale, and they have to produce eggs, and then the eggs go into something like some kind of a crustacean like a krill. And
yeah.
Then the krill then has to be eaten again by the whale. And so these things live in blue whales, and they put out literally hundreds of millions of eggs per day, just blasting out into the ocean in the feces of the whale. And then these krill have to eat them. Then the krill has to be eaten by a whale. So as you can see, the probabilities are low that the life cycle of any one egg would actually make it to the next host. But if you put out enough, eventually some will, and it works for the whales.
What's amazing about a tapeworm of a whale, though, is it's got to go through all those pressure changes that a diving whale goes through, and it's in the ocean.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, too, and apparently, yeah, that's really interesting, because I would just wonder whether or not it affects them, but apparently it doesn't. So it's an interesting aspect of parasitology is that we just don't know much. We just really don't know much about what's going on out there.
The whole history of the science of parasitology is fascinating. In the book, you talk about Eric Hoberg. Is it Hoberg?
Yes, Hoberg, yeah.
A tapeworm parasitologist. He started out, he didn't originally want to be a parasitologist. He wanted to study seabirds.
Yes, he was he really was into ornithology, and then he took parasitology from my uncle. And he became enamored with parasites, and then off he went. He became the curator at the U.S. National Museum there for 20 years.
He did a lot of research on the beef tapeworm.
Yes, he's been working on these parasites of human health importance. They're called Tinea is the genus, and there's several species of these Tinea that occur in people. And if you like to eat raw beef and you don't live in North America, then, well, if you don't live in the United States, then you have a good chance of getting some beef tapeworm by eating beef tartare, if you like that.
Yeah.
Especially if you go to South America and have beef tartare, which I probably wouldn't recommend.
There's also great stories in this book about field research. There's some really good, great stories of the Nebraska sandhills.
Yes. And
can you talk about what that habitat is? Because that sounds like I want to visit that area.
Oh, it's one of the last areas. It is the last area of unplowed tall grass and short grass prairie, mostly tall. Well, it's not even tall grass. It's just unplowed prairie in North America, and it's huge. It goes all the way from the western part of the state all the way to the northeastern part, and it's all stabilized sand dunes. And
wow,
the sand dunes stabilized when the climate became a little bit wetter, and they now just they're just all grass. And there's some areas there that have blown out the sand, and there's lots of lakes up there, and there's saline lakes.
Wow.
And it's really interesting. The people who first moved here didn't want to go out there much because they didn't think there was much there. And it was also difficult and easy to get lost because all those sand dunes are just, it's huge. It's actually, if the sand dunes were moving again, it would be the largest area of sand dunes on the planet.
See, now, the whole ecology of the area is fascinating to me. But the research on parasites has to do with grasshopper mice and pocket gophers. And I've never seen a grasshopper mouse, but I know about it from reading golden guides to mammals, and they look fascinating. They're a very tiny species of mouse.
Yeah, those are grasshopper mice are anichomies, and there's three species of them in North America. The one that occurs out there is called Anichomes leucogaster, white-bellied anichomy.
Yep.
And they are almost all insectivorous, and so they just eat mostly insects. They do eat plant material, but mostly they're going for insects.
Now, there are these pocket gophers, and both the grasshopper mice and the pocket gophers bump into each other a lot.
They do, because the gophers make the burrows, and the burrows are pervasive. Everywhere in the sandhills, there are pocket gophers, and they basically they're the natural plows of the system there. In fact, all over North America, and the western part of North America especially, there are pocket gophers that are continuously working the soil.
Now,
up there in the sandhills, these two species interact, although they don't share the same parasites at all. It's very interesting.
That's what I don't get. So you have these two species. In any kind of theory, you would think they would both have at least some overlap in parasites, but they don't share any species of parasites?
They do not, and that's an interesting thing, because I thought when I first was working there and I caught these pocket gophers, I looked at them, I found the tapeworms, and I said, "Oh, this is the same species of tapeworm I described when I was working in Colorado for my master's with a guy named Jerry Schmidt." And so it was in the sandy area of eastern Colorado near Greeley, Colorado. But now I was working in western Nebraska in these sandy areas. I thought it was going to be the same thing, and it was the same tapeworm in the gophers. Then we collected these anichomes here, both here and also down on the Civieta National Wildlife Refuge in New Mexico, where there's a long-term ecological research site, which we did a lot of work on. And it's the same tapeworm in the anichomes all the way from New Mexico to Nebraska, but it's not the same one as in the gophers, which is really interesting in by itself.
There's also, we're going to run out of time, but there's a great section on you doing research on the tuku-tuku.
Oh, man, that's my favorite. I love subterranean rodents.
It's the tuco-tuco and the pink fairy armadillo.
Yes, the tuco is interacts with the armadillos down there because the pink fairy armadillos, they're burrowing animals, and so is the tucos. There's about 70 species of tinomis, of tucos in South America. They extend all the way from about the level of Lake Titicaca up on the Altiplano, about 4,000 meters, somewhere in there, all the way to Tierra del Fuego. And Tierra del Fuego is the tip of South America. And so, but they're all different species, and they've speciated like mad. That means they've formed new species since the Pliocene, it's just a few million years. And so, of course, they're interacting with these other animals down there, and there is evidence that there were some changes and exchanges of some of the nematodes a long time ago from the xenarthrans, from the armadillo-like animals, into the rodent lineage, and then there was another speciation burst in the rodent lineages. And also in those tucos, there's a lot of these species of these nematodes in the tucos. Of course, it's different from the ones in the armadillos. So there's really no shared parasites except for some that utilize the, there just aren't any shared ones. There's a few of the tapeworms that might jump into them that use them as intermediate hosts, like Tinea, for instance. But we don't have any good data on that.
But this brings up the importance of parasites and being able to sort of understand better the evolution of organisms.
Yes, and we've been working on trying to understand what we used to call host switching, and it's actually called ecological fitting now. Dan Jansen published a paper in 1985 or so where he called it On Ecological Fitting, where basically he was working on plants and pollinators, and he was seeing that these animals were jumping from host to host, and there was no real co-speciation going on. There was a lot of host switching, or what we call ecological fitting.
Scott, we're going to have to say goodbye because we're all out of time, and we could have talked about this book for so much more.
I know. Call back.
We've been talking. My guest tonight has been Scott L. Gardner, curator of parasites in the H.W. Manter Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska State Museum and professor of biological sciences at the University of Nebraska Lincoln. His new book, and you can tell it's a fascinating book, written with Judy Diamond and Gabor Rash, is Parasites, The Inside Story. Trust me, it's a good book. Scott, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was great.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.